Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Rajashree Varia about her contemporary novel, The Daughters of Madurai. Rajashree was born in Bangalore and raised in Sydney. She's an award-winning short story writer, marathon runner, and self-described history nerd, and she now lives in London. In this episode, we discuss how she was inspired by a shocking news story about infanticide, which she remembered from her childhood, why her intense research trip to India made her complex characters more authentic, and finding a way to give agency to historically and culturally oppressed female characters. But first, here's Rajashree with an excerpt from The Daughters of Madurai.
Madurai, India, 1992. Almost 2 months before her conception. She does not exist, even in thought. Janani knew, the minute the midwife placed her naked, squalling, soft-as-silk daughter in her arms, that she couldn't lose this one. An image came to her mind, burying a bundle gone cold and still in the dirt by the young coconut palm. Her hands drew the hated little body closer. Tiny limbs moved in fitful pumps as Janani looked down into a face as round and purple as a mangosteen. The baby's mouth shifted over the swollen skin of her breast, and her plaintive wail died as she found the nipple and began to feed. Her minute fingers rested against the skin over Janani's heart. Janani watched her in the light of the oil lamp, her eyes trailing along each line of her body, trying to find something that made her less than perfect. Rock, my little peacock. The lullaby escaped through her lips, the first words she'd managed since that last pain-riddled push. Hands were fussing around her, tender and papery. Kamala, the old, strong midwife who had delivered most of the rest of Usilampathi district over what seemed like centuries. Janani barely noticed until someone spoke. Give her to me. Pain and weariness turned what should have been a familiar voice into a half-recognized echo. No, Janani tried to say. It stayed a tired whisper in her mind. She wanted to hold this new life for as long as she could. There was a rough fumble, nails scratching against her forearms, and the warmth of newborn, new-drawn skin was gone. Her daughter began to cry again. The noise stuttered into existence, like a steam engine's chugs. The door closed, muffling the sound.
Hi, Rajashree. Welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to have you on with me today to discuss your debut novel, Daughters of Madurai.
Chloe, it's such a joy to join you today. Thank you for inviting me on.
Oh, it's so lovely to have you. Before we started recording, you just said some lovely things about the podcast, so it is a real pleasure to have you on with me today. Can you start by introducing your novel, Daughters of Madurai, for us, and tell us what it's all about?
Yes, of course. So Daughters of Madurai is a dual timeline novel that tracks the relationship between a mother and a daughter. Janani is a young woman in sort of early 90s South India. She is the mother of a daughter, and she's pregnant again, and she will do whatever it takes to save the life of her unborn child. And then 25 years later, we follow the story of Neela, who grew up in Australia and knows very little about her mother's background, Neela goes back to India to visit her alien grandfather, and as part of that journey, she uncovers more about her mother's past, which has been secret to her for so long, and also builds up the courage to reveal a secret of her own. So, very much about mother and daughter relationships and family mysteries.
Yeah, and I guess a little bit about identity and kind of knowing who you are, and as well as kind of exploring this kind of darker, well, tragedy, I guess, that was happening at the time. I found the kind of genesis of this novel fascinating, because I read that this novel began life way, way back when you watched a news program that kind of stuck with you from childhood. Can you tell us about that, and kind of had you been thinking of this idea for many, many years? How did it all begin?
Great question. It's really funny because I've always wanted to be a writer, and I've read as many writers do most of my life, and read a lot of fantasy. And so when I started writing, it was actually fantasy that I was dabbling in for a novel. But when I thought about a story that would really sort of resonate with me to write, it came back to this moment of when I was about 9 or 10 years old, and I was watching a news segment with my parents. And essentially, it was a case of female infanticide in Bangalore, which is where I was born, in Bangalore, South India. And at that age, I remember my mum saying something like, "Bangalore, that's where you were born." And what the thought that really struck me was that could have been me, that little girl. I was a little girl born in Bangalore, and this little girl born, a few streets away from where I once lived, had been murdered because she was a girl. And that really struck me. I think from that age on, I was always passionate about sort of women's and children's rights. And when I thought about a novel, I was like, I really wanted to explore this complex emotion I had around female infanticide, what it was about, what caused it. I mean, it just seems like such an unthinkable action to kill your own child. And simply because of their sex is just, it just blew my mind. So I think for me to write this novel, it was almost a bit of a scratching a selfish need to understand more about it and delve into the research. And that's what I had a chance to do.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it, how sometimes there are these topics that are really emotive somehow to you that then stay with you for years and years, and like you said, you kind of kept coming back to it, and although you were interested in or read a lot of fantasy, it was somehow not quite connecting until you found this topic. How do you then, I'm intrigued to know whether you've kind of half written a novel or tried writing novels before this.
No, I do have a first draft of an epic fantasy novel somewhere on this laptop somewhere. I mean, at some point, I'd love to explore fantasy because I do think it's a fascinating genre. But I think I've written a lot of short stories in the past as well, and I've always used writing as a way to sort of express my emotions around certain social issues. I feel like I can't. Sometimes you feel helpless about around certain things that you're really passionate about. Writing, I think, is a way for you to like process that emotion. I mean, I think I loved writing The Daughters of Mother Eye. I loved exploring this very emotive social issue that was so close to me. I've done it before, so it's a genre I think I'd like to keep writing in as well.
Absolutely. I wondered whether, because obviously the kind of initial spark of the idea came from this very dark topic, and I wondered whether you'd, because this novel is a dual timeline, I wondered whether you had always envisioned it that way, or whether you'd once kind of just focused on the kind of historical side, and not had a kind of present day strand.
A great question. And yes, initially I had just looked at following Janani's storyline. And actually, I think it's quite interesting when you're writing about sort of current issues, that there is sometimes this urge to almost save the world when you're writing it. You're almost trying to, through your writing, almost find out how you can solve the issue. And in a way, like I think writing does allow you to sort of explore that a little bit. But ultimately, like, I think it's not the issue that I'm writing about. It's about the relationships and the people, and, you know, the issue doesn't exist in sort of a vacuum. And I think, so for me, initially when I was writing about it, I was sort of, you know, trying to almost save Janani from the situation. But actually, the characters sort of came in and their relationships came in, and through that I was able to sort of tie in the storyline of actually what happens to her after. And I think the other thing I really wanted to explore was this: a lot of us who live in a diasporic community, it's a very strange sort of dichotomy of identity that we've got. You know, I'm Australian, for example, but I very much relate to being Indian because I was born there, I spent a lot of time there, and they're two completely different worlds. And I think for me, being able to explore both Janani and Neela's stories and their relationship with each other, I was sort of able to look at how you can sort of reconcile those two completely different worlds and those two different identities.
Yeah. And I think as well, with what you were saying about kind of wanting to go in and save the situation, I think when you're dealing with a topic that is A, real, and B, incredibly tragic, you don't want to necessarily go in and make things unreal by giving everyone like a really neat, happy ending, or making things, you know, have, you know, easy solutions. But the way, I'm not going to give any spoilers, but the way you deal with the topic leaves room for a feeling of kind of hope, and also a feeling of, you know, that things have managed to resolve themselves without it shying away from the bitter realities of life, I guess. That's the vaguest way I can put it. But I feel like, yeah, I think having the second timeline allows you to do that, because it adds a little bit of distance. And I think if you perhaps had not had the second timeline, it might have been maybe a more unrelentingly dark topic or story. I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, no, you know what? You're spot on. That's exactly what I wanted to do. Was, yes, it is a very grim topic, but I'm an idealist and I like a happy ending, and I definitely wanted to find the hope in the situation. I think there is hope in the situation, and I did want to sort of make sure that came through at the end. And then the distance is, yeah, again, it is so important to have that there, it's not all about the grimness of the issue. And I think when I went to India, and I think we'll talk about this a little bit later, when I went to India and spoke to the communities there, amongst whom, you know, this practice still exists today, what I found was that hope is there. You know, these people are lovely people, warm people who are living lives in which they have fun and they laugh and they love. And I wanted to make sure that came through, that, you know, all of that existed alongside this, you know, this very tragic practice.
Okay, so let's go back to that topic then, because I know you spent a lot of time working for a charity there, and that must have massively helped writing this novel. So tell us how that fed into your writing.
Yeah, absolutely. So I wanted to learn more about the issue, and I sought out a charity in South India, and I found that there are a few villages in the district of Madurai that where this practice became endemic. We don't really know how long it has existed for, because, you know, families just don't talk about it really, but definitely sort of throughout the 20th century. And it was uncovered sort of in the late 1980s. There were essentially like five or six different sort of villages where this was taking place. And one of the villages is quite close actually to where some of my family from Kerala, but some of them actually moved to Madurai three or four decades ago. And they live very close to that area. So actually, when I went there, I identified this grassroots organization run by two sort of local people who look to sort of empower women and girls and look to fight the causes of the endemic causes of female infanticide, which is cultural, it's economic, it's social. So trying to sort of take a three-pronged approach to sort of stamping it out essentially. So I was able to stay with my family, visit my family, and spend some time with this organization, shadowing them and understanding sort of how they go about what they do in tackling the issue. But also, I was really fortunate to they took me to meet families where who had been practicing female infanticide, and I was able to speak to them and get their views on the practice. And I think, I mean, that was just so helpful. I think for me, I went there and they were so similar. I mean, their lives were very different because these were more rural people, so a lot of their family were involved in agriculture and other sort of more subsistence living. But you know, so culture and the religion, and it was all similar to, you know, what I'd experienced with my family. So I definitely found sort of an element of relatability there. But also I was able to sort of really understand why the practice was occurring and why it was so difficult to break. I was able to understand sort of, you know, the systemic sort of degradation of women and like their status in society meant that you had this like vicious circle of mother-in-laws treating daughter-in-laws dreadfully, and a lack of value on women, and the fact that, you know, until sort of recently, the last 20, 30 years, women couldn't open a bank account in their own name. They were completely dependent on their husbands. They obviously, the family name passed down from father to son. So women just didn't exist in the historical record. It's like they weren't there. And then obviously because of this, there was this, you know, fundamental value on having a son. Sons also were the ones to perform the funeral rites. So if you didn't have a son, it was essentially as though you couldn't reach enlightenment. You couldn't reach moksha because you didn't have a son to perform your funeral rites. So all of this was just built in culturally, and trying to tackle all of that was, it was really difficult, you know, quite difficult to sort of, you know, deal with from within. So I was really able to understand that when I was there, and I was able to write about it, I think, a lot more sympathetically and hopefully a lot more realistically, authentically than I would have done if I had not visited and spoke to these families.
Absolutely. That was one of the questions I had for you as well, because I think if you're just given that topic to kind of think about, you automatically take a stance of this is horrendous, you know, it's tragic, it's awful, which it is. But I think what your novel explores, like you say, is the reasons why. And one of your characters is Janani's mother-in-law, who I guess is we'd see her, if you want to be black and white about things, as the kind of more of the villain of the piece. But for you as the writer, you have to empathize with her, otherwise you don't write her authentically. So, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of readers that would, you know, completely take against her, but did you have to kind of spend time wrestling with her motivations and who she was to kind of make her as real as possible?
Yeah, absolutely. And it took time because I think initially, I mean, you're right. It is difficult to think of that situation as not black and white. I mean, it just seems awful to practice female infanticide. So initially, it was quite easy to write her as a villain, particularly because I'm writing from Janani's point of view, and then for her, you know, Vandana is the villain. But I'm also, you know, the narrator and the author, I need to sort of make sure that she comes across as sympathetic in a way. And I think, again, that sort of idea of generational trauma and, you know, the abused becoming the abuser is it exists in many other contexts, not just in this one. And I think tapping into that a little bit made it a lot easier for me to think about sort of how did Vandana get to where she is, and think about the fact that, but for a twist in circumstance, that could be Janani replicating the same behavior onto her own in-law, like, you know, children-in-law, daughters-in-law. So that did make it easier. And you know, I met women when I was there who had practiced female infanticide, who had had it inflicted upon them, who had female members of their own family, like actively coming after their babies to take them away and kill them, and you know, trying to understand why this was happening, I think really helped me sort of shape London's character.
Absolutely. I want because I haven't asked you yet about your two leading ladies. I just want to touch back on them for a second. Obviously, we've talked a little bit about Janine, and she. I wondered what it was like to kind of write a character who is very oppressed within her society and within her family, even, but you don't want to make her this kind of passive character. You want to make her active, and you want to kind of give her strength and agency and bravery. How hard is that to do when everyone around her is quite controlling?
It was really hard to do. It was really hard to do. And I needed to try and ensure that, as you said, things did not just happen to her, because that is often the case. It can be very difficult when you're in this circumstance to find ways to assert your agency. So I had to really, ensure that the cast of characters around her were enabled her to allow her to express some level of freedom. I think, again, thinking about it, getting to the detail, getting through like specific plot points, and again, relating it back to sort of my experience there and my experience throughout sort of my upbringing and spending time in India, and understanding how women in particular are able to express agency. I think there is very strong relationships that not everybody is controlling. There are these relationships of strength and friendship and love. And I think characters like Kamala, the midwife, who acts almost like a surrogate mother and advisor, and Shubha, who is that best friend, the sister, providing that strength. And then obviously Sanjay and his family. There are pockets there where she's able to practice her resilience, for want of a better term, and then find, the light, and then find a way out of her situation. The other thing is, I mean, luck is involved, right? You need having the right people in your life and having them able to provide you with opportunity that you wouldn't necessarily, or someone else wouldn't necessarily have, I think is part and parcel of life. So, that definitely does exist. But yeah, it was important for me to sort of bring together, Janani's characteristics as well as the right sort of cast of characters around her and opportunity to be able to sort of allow her that agency.
And what about Neela then? How did you create her character?
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of Nila is definitely drawn from my background. I'm a runner. I grew up in Western Sydney, so there's a bit of that. A lot of my friends from Australia will also point out the fact that there is a scene in Cargo Bar, which is notorious nightlife place in Sydney Harbour. So there a bit of it definitely drawn from my own background. But then again, like I think the just natural extrapolation of Janani moving with this young child to Australia and how she finds her feet and finds her identity in what is a very multicultural city. Sydney is very multicultural, and just how you would then move from that to sort of questioning your background. I think a lot of people, when you are going through childhood, you don't, it just happens to you. You don't necessarily sort of question where you came from or new parents' behavior and why they act the way they do. And then there's that point in life, particularly when you're starting to make significant life choices, where you wonder why your parents have acted the way they do. And I think getting to that point in her life where she's actually like really questioning her background, it was quite interesting to explore, and sort of unpacking her relationship then with her mother.
You talked a little bit about Sydney then, and I mean both aspects of your one aspect of your writing, which I thought was beautiful, is your the way you write setting and location, and you balance it so well because it's not like you have, reams of description about a place, but it feels very active and very real moving around your characters. So how did you achieve that to kind of make it fit around the story rather than the story fitting around the setting descriptions?
Thank you. That's really lovely to hear. I think just to touch on that point, like I think, I've got some lovely feedback from readers. And for me, always it's particularly people from an Indian background or who live in India, in South India, and say it comes across as so authentic. I'm like, that's amazing. So I didn't live in India. So for me, it was very important that it came across as authentic. So thank you. To be honest, I think there's one of my lecturers probably at UEA who mentioned like when you are writing a character story, you should draw the setting as they would see it. So I think, really getting into the minds of the characters and the experiences that they're going through certain scenes and identifying what about those, what the specifics are about a scene that are important to them and relevant to them, and making sure I'm bringing those out in detail, I think was a really good way for me, helpful way for me to think about it. So I tried to do that as much as possible and make sure that, it was at relevant points during a character's journey through a particular scene that I was able to sort of, bring out the setting. I'm glad it came across well though.
I'd love to go back in time and touch on your writing journey from your beginning to now. And I know you mentioned UEA, and I know you did a creative writing, was it a master's you did there? Yeah.
Yes, yeah.
So at what point in your life then did you decide to kind of, I guess we often use the phrase, don't we, like take writing seriously, but how did it go from being a hobby to something you really actively pursued?
Yeah, so I sort of fell in love with writing when I was at high school, like I think a lot of writers probably did. And but then obviously I have South Asian parents, and I'm the eldest child as well. So it was very much about serious career first, serious career in quotation marks first. So I went to university and studied finance and all of the practical things, and got a job in insurance. But I always wanted to be from my teenagers, wanted to be a writer. So during sort of my first years of work, I was doing sort of courses with the Australian Writers Centre. I was based in Sydney at the time, and then when I moved over to London about 8 years ago now, it was very much sort of the young Australian jump on the youth visa, come over to work and travel and live the London lifestyle. And the move meant that I wasn't doing very much writing. I'd already started, actually. I just started writing the very first draft of what would become The Daughters of Motherai at the time. And I just didn't do any writing for about a year and a half, 2 years. And at that point, I was like, well, I could either can, do a bit of additional study in like another career path and go down like sort of the corporate world, or I could see if I could get into UEA and do a writing master's. And I heard a couple of authors, Natasha Pulley in particular, talk about UEA masters, and she loved it. And I love her writing. That's what made me look into the course to begin with. And I was like, I'll apply. And actually, if I do get in, it almost gives me license to focus on my writing. You know, I think otherwise, and a lot of writers will say the same thing. I'm sure, Chloe, you felt the same thing. When you start out, you feel like you're writing in a void and nobody cares. You know, who cares that you're writing? It feels like there's nobody holding you to account. And for me, doing the master's was very much sort of the required, you know, accountability and the discipline needed to actually take my writing seriously. So that's what I did, and I really enjoyed it. I did it part-time alongside working full-time, and it was absolutely insane. it was tough, but I really enjoyed it. And you know, that's sort of where the novel in its close to its current form was completed.
Oh, wow. I was going to say then, you do sound mad doing the course part-time and working full-time at the same time. And I know you've got a lot on your plate at the moment anyway. So for you, I mean, I guess at the moment your kind of writing life was changed a little bit, but for you, what would be kind of like a ideal writing day? What would it look like?
That's a really good question. So I think for me, it's an interesting one. I do find having work alongside my writing means that I don't procrastinate as much when it comes to writing, because I just don't have the time to procrastinate. And so I definitely do feel like that balance works for me. So normally when I'm working, I'll try and get up early and do a couple of hours before I start work. So if I'm up at like 5-ish to get some writing done, and then do a day of work. It's funny, once I've done my writing hours, I feel like I've done what I needed for the day. Work is just sort of, you know, ancillary to that. But then I write a lot on the weekends as well. And for me, it's very much getting some exercise out early in the day. I feel like that, you know, gets my creative juices flowing. And then I'll sort of do 2 hours and have a break and then another couple of hours. That was before I had my baby, and things have now changed. But yeah, for me, that's ideal, like a couple of hours. And then in the evenings, I like to do a bit of research, and that's just fun. You know, either reading other novels or actively researching a current or a future story idea.
Mm. So you mentioned that you kind of completed your novel on the master's course. Were you at that point then looking for an agent? How did your kind of journey to getting an agent pan out?
Yeah, it was really interesting for me, and I feel very, very fortunate. During the master's, I actually didn't work on the book too much. I used the master's as a way to explore other writing styles, other genres, work on, you know, different pieces. And then UEA allows us to essentially publish an anthology of about 10,000 words, might be slightly less than that actually, across the sort of the cohort. And that then goes out to a handful of agents who work with UEA. And from that, actually, I was contacted by an agent who was interested in reading more. So I sent her the first 10,000 words, and then she wanted to read the whole novel. And I was like, well, I better write it then. So I really knuckled down, and I was like, actually, someone's expecting this. So that gave me a great sort of deadline. I got the first draft, redrafted it actually over about 2 months, sent it out and to her. And then actually I was like, well, if I'm sending it out to her, I may send it out to another handful of agents to just see what the feedback is like. So I sent it out to a further 5 agents. And from that round, I had 4 requests for fulls and then 3 offers of representation, wow. Which was mad. I was not expecting it at all. And I was like, I don't even know what to do with this. Like, you, as a writer, I think you're like, if an agent offers me representation, I'll be like, hell yes, like I don't care who it is. But being able to sort of obviously look at agents that I would have loved to work with and then send it out and get three people coming back and saying, would love to represent you. I was over the moon. And one of those agents was all wonderful agents, but one of those agents was Juliet Mushins, who is my agent, and she was my dream agent. She represents amazing authors. She is an absolute superwoman. Like, I don't know how she works the way she works, but she does. And I was so over the moon. So I had a call with her, and you know, she was lovely. This was during COVID times, so over Zoom, and I accepted her offer of representation. And it was crazy because I went out on submission in September, and then by November I'd signed with Juliet, and I still don't know how it happened. But I feel very, very fortunate.
No, absolutely. Alan, absolutely, your writing is beautiful, and I'm sure that really captured her attention also because, like I mentioned to you before we started recording, it's a really unique story, and I think that's what people are looking for, really. I think it's stories that we haven't heard before. I wanted to ask you a question. Obviously, we won't discuss who the other agents were, but I wondered how you kind of made up your mind. I mean, Juliet was your kind of dream, but what was it you were kind of thinking about and looking for in the kind of that when you were kind of deciding about agents? Because obviously you had that initial interest. Were you kind of thinking about the kind of writer you wanted to be long term? What was kind of going through your mind at the time?
Yeah, definitely. I had considered looking for agents who would be interested in representing not just this novel, but potentially other genres that I would potentially be interested in writing in longer term. And I think switching genres is very difficult, but I do see writers doing it more frequently. I feel like it's really nice not to feel like you're pigeonholed writing a certain type of story for the entirety of your career. I mean, we don't all read one genre exclusively, so why would we write in one genre exclusively? Mm. So that was really important to me. But I think, you know, it was tough because the other agents, as I said, were absolutely lovely. I definitely was looking for someone I had a rapport with, so someone I just felt like I could get along with. I think that's really important because you need, I think, open communication in an agent-writer, agent-author relationship. So that was really important to me. But I think the other thing that really appealed to me about Juliet, actually, is she's just very, I think it's my corporate hat. Like, I've worked in the corporate industry for so long. I think she just came across as such a businesswoman as well. And she is, like, she obviously owns and runs her own agency and is very successful doing that. So I think that kind of was both intimidating, but also it's like, actually, that really appeals to me. She just really feels like someone who gets shit done.
Yeah. And that is exactly what you want. Particularly, like you say, when it comes to the business side of things, you know, unless I was going to say we're artists, but that always sounds a bit wanky when I say something like that. But it is true. We'll stick to the art side, and that's what agents are for. That's what, you know, agents are there to do the deals and the money and everything else. How much work did you do with Juliet in terms of kind of editorial work before you sent the book out on submission?
Yeah, so I did another two drafts with Juliet, but they weren't huge. It wasn't huge sort of structural type stuff. We definitely made it tighter. There were certain scenes and characters that need to shift and change and be removed. So we did two further drafts. So I signed with her in the November, and then we went out on submission in April the following year, 2021.
And was it quick? Was it painful? How was it for you?
It was the redrafting process or the submission
process? The submission process.
It was terrifying. It was funny because I obviously had, you know, gone down all the rabbit holes online around what the submission process would be like, what to expect. And I said to Juliet, how long do you think it will take? expecting her to say, look, you know, 6 months, whatever. I no anticipation. She's like, we'll have an answer by the end of 4 weeks. And I was like, what? But yeah, I mean, it was 2 weeks, I think, between submission and having the book deal. So it was much speedier than I anticipated. And thank God, because it was terrifying. And I, you know, a lot of that is due to Julia. And I think people just pick up what she sends out. So I'm very, very fortunate to have her.
Yeah, absolutely. So we talk quite a lot about the kind of ups and downs of being published and being a debut. And I wondered, is there anything that you kind of wish you'd known before, or wish you'd known kind of almost the day you signed your book deal, that you kind of wish you could go back in time and say to yourself, like, it's going to be all right? Or what advice would you have given to yourself? And what advice can you give to 2024's debuts that are just about to go out into the world?
I think probably a couple of things. So one, if you feel uncomfortable about anything, speak to your agent. Your agent is your biggest champion. Have the conversation with them. If they will tell you if something is normal or if it's not, or actually they think, you know, something needs to be addressed, and they'll be able to explain things. I mean, I think we spend a lot of time, you know, they'll be, you know, there's usually sort of like an 18 month, if you're lucky, but 2 year lag between the time you sign your book deal and your debut novel going out. And in that 2 years, your publisher's got a lot of other stuff going on. So there'll be times of silence when you just don't know what's going on. And it's absolutely okay to ask the question, what is going on? Do you need anything from me? Do you have everything in hand? And your agent will 100%, you know, fight that battle for you if a battle needs to be fought, I think, and be able to clarify a lot for you as well. So make sure that you've got that communication with your agent, with your publisher. And then I think probably the other thing is, it's very difficult, but ultimately there's a lot of this is out of our control, like particularly when you've got the book deal. Like, you can definitely look into what you can do in terms of self-promotion and marketing and all that sort of stuff. But ultimately, I mean, you said it before, Chloe, we're the artists, we are the writers, and our specialty here is really, it's the writing. What we want to be doing is the writing. So I think ask the questions of the, you know, industry professionals, the agents and the publishers, and focus on the next thing. I think the best thing that we can do to help our careers is to keep writing. So, you know, for me, okay, the book is out there, it's doing what it's doing, this process happened, but you know, I can do really to make sure that I have longevity in my writing career is to keep writing. So just focusing on churning out the next, say churning out right now, doing a lot of churning, so doing what you can to enhance your writing career. So if that's reading, if that's research, and if obviously the writing, as much as you can, I think try and focus on that.
Absolutely. Easier said than done, I think we would all agree, but 100% the only thing we can do is write, really, at the end of the day, and hopefully write better books as we keep going. That note, finally, I'd love if you could give us a little teaser about what you're working on next.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am working on my second novel, which is a contemporary fiction. Again, family secrets, family relationships, but this one, what I'm exploring is the perception of mental illness in South Asian society, particularly, you know, sort of framed by one South Indian family. Again, it's a dual timeline novel set within sort of 1970s India and 2020s London. And explores the relationship between a young woman and her father, and explores sort of intergenerational mental illness and how that sort of transcends family and society. So
that sounds great. Really good. And how is book two going? Is it, are you finding it difficult kind of trying to get into a new set of characters, or have you found it quite refreshing to step into new shoes?
It's a bit of both. I think I really enjoyed stepping into new shoes. It is really difficult, though. It is difficult, and I think a lot of people will say that book two is hard. You almost like come to it and you're like, how did I write the first one? But I am enjoying it. It's very challenging, but I am enjoying it. I very much feel like it is like piecing together a very, very hard 1,000-piece puzzle. You know, it's quite interesting. And it's letting me sort of delve into areas that I find really interesting and exploring sort of the history of the region and, you know, different perceptions of different things. And I just like very much opening my mind to be able to do this. So I keep telling myself that during the difficult days, and I'm like, this scene is just not working. What am I trying to say here? What am I doing? But ultimately, it's hard work, but I am enjoying it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I absolutely cannot wait to see what it is and read it, and I really look forward to it. Rajashree, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you so much, Chloe, for having me. I really appreciate it. I really enjoyed it.
That was Rajashree Varia talking about her contemporary novel, The Daughters of Madurai, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it would be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.